Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a book, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the
air. Hi everyone, this is your host Fran Lewis, and this is MJ Network, and we sure are live, and we are live with the author of Flight of the Fox, Gary Bathnight. Good morning, how are you?
Good morning, Fran. So nice to be speaking with you. How is it going there?
We're expecting Florence in a couple of hours, and we really don't want her here. We would like her to move somewhere else, seriously.
Well, I'm presently in Toronto, Canada, phoning in from where I've just had a book event last evening, which went wonderfully well, and I don't want to encounter Florence either.
No, I don't like her. My best friend was Florence, and she wasn't that violent. I mean, really, seriously. So, this book was really interesting, and your publicist asked me to read it, and I'm glad I did. And we're talking about a very interesting topic. University mathematics professor Sam DeGarden is on the sun deck of his weekend home in upstate New York when he hears what sounds like a hummingbird, except it was a drone that tries to kill him. Oh, wow. That is scary. So the main character is a math professor who worked for the CIA in the past. Why did you put him in this situation? And I'd be scared to death, too, if I saw Ford Jones coming at me.
Well, it's quite a beginning for a thriller, run for your life novel. He is a mathematics professor at Columbia University, which is, of course, in New York City. But the opening scene is at his pied-à-terre in the town of Bethel, New York, which is north and west of the city, in Sullivan County. And it's world famous as the site of the August 1969 Woodstock Rock Festival. So he's sitting on the sun deck of his home there in Bethel, New York, when, for reasons he has no idea why, suddenly drones seek to kill him. And he manages to survive that experience, and that is what propels him to run for his life, to leave his home and make a mad dash down the East Coast from upstate New York to New York City to Washington, D.C., and ultimately to Key West, Florida. You know, it's kind of a takeoff, kind of a spinoff, inspired by the old novels by Robert Ludlum, who was the father of the whole Jason Bourne franchise. So my character, Sam Teagarden, is a mathematics professor, so he offers quite an alternative to readers who love the Jason Bourne series, in that Sam Teagarden is rather an everyman in that he does not have a black belt in karate, and he's not a spy or a secret agent or a black ops killer in any way. He just has his intelligence and his will to live. And I thought it would be fun to offer that sort of alternative and start out with an action scene there where he survives an attempt to kill him by these four drones, and he has no idea why. But he knows that he wants to live, and he knows that he has to figure out what's going on in his life and why some mysterious force who's manipulating these drones may want to see him suffer his demise.
That is very true, for whatever reason, but we won't tell anybody why. But it seems to be, I just read one by T. Jefferson Parker, Sweet Vengeance, and it seems that the main character there also was a drone operator. She was a censor. So it seems that this is what, you know, I've been getting a lot of them, and I don't read all of them, trust me. But this one is like, okay, this is good. I've read over 8,500 books, seriously, in the 3 years that I've been doing this thing, and this is different. And I've done panels. Yeah, seriously. Like, I never know. You know, there are times that I open the book up and I'm going, oh, God, do I have to really read that? Oh, my God, no, don't do this to me. And then I picked up this one and I said, okay, good. And I just sat down and read it. Seriously, just sat down and read it, which is a compliment because that means that I couldn't put it down. So, tell us about Sam and he reacts and who's after him. And the sad part is where you meet a box of tissues about Billy and how he uses an app on the phone. This was so cool. On his phone as a camera to see Sam's yard property and hopefully who's after him. How did you come up with that? That was really cool. Seriously.
Well, you know, when I started writing this, I don't work with an outline, although I do tend to see the entire arc of the narrative. So I know sort of the beginning, the middle, and I know, I may not know the exact ending, but I know the sentiment that I want the reader to feel when the ending is reached. But I don't know the details. The details are invented paragraph by paragraph. And so as I was writing that opening scene, it occurred to me to have some fun with the boy next door, who is your basic techno wizard, as all children are. You know, the old joke about when you buy a new TV or a new router, you have to ask the kid who lives next door to come in and help you program it. So while he's on the run during that first stage, that very first night when he's in the woods of the Catskill Mountains, he calls the boy next door, and he asks for the boy to go up in his treehouse in his backyard and tell him what's going on at his house. And one of the things, his name is Billy Carney. And Billy Carney says, hey, Professor Teagarden, I can do even better than just looking for my treehouse. I can set my phone on an app-to-app program. This is fiction. I invented it. But who knows? Maybe it will come to pass in the near term. He sets his phone camera so that Sam Teagarden, who's hiding in the woods, can then be dialed in and see on his phone what Billy is seeing on his phone. So it's called lens-to-lens networking. And it's a way of just sort of seeing what someone else that you're talking to is actually themselves seeing with their camera in their smartphone. And it's through that lens-to-lens networking that Sam Teagarden, hiding in the woods, is able to understand that there's some very mysterious men at his house. And even though he survived the drones, which is wonderful, he still has a problem because men are going through his house and they're doing some very strange things, and it's simply not safe for him to go back. And then, of course, tragedy happens. I won't reveal too much about it, but Billy got a little too close to Sam Teagarden's house, so let's just leave that portion at that. But at this portion of the story, the mathematics professor, Sam Teagarden, realizes exactly how much trouble he's in and exactly how dangerous these people are. And so he knows he has to get out of the county and get into that place called New York City, where it may be easier to hide among the large crowd of 8 million people strong. And that's what he seeks to do. And even from there, he has to continue on, as I said, from D.C. to Key West, where he has family in Key West, Florida. So it's quite a run for your life. And I just want to say I'm so thrilled that you 8,500 books is a lot of books. I don't envy you.
Sure it is.
But the fact that you read this and that you do consider it a page turner is music to the ears of any writer. So I certainly appreciate it, and thank you very much for saying that.
Thank you. It's the truth, let me tell you. You never know what I'm going to pick up. Yeah. And my husband, we just bought me a new computer, and he's allowing me to use it for this show. Would you believe? I'm allowed to look at it now. And because he sort of took over. He said, oh, you don't really want to use the new one. Yeah, I do. And he counted how many reviews I did on the old one. And I said, I really did that many? He said, yeah, that's how many you read. It's because my mother made me read 10 books a week, and I'm still reading that many if I can. Every single week, taking notes and whatever, yeah. So I said, you know what, this was interesting. And Lisa sent me an email. I said, okay, well, I'll try that. Were you at the Thriller Fest by any chance? Did I miss you there?
I was briefly at Thriller Fest earlier in the summer, and we must have missed each other. Yes, I'm so sorry. And
yeah, I was
also
there.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I was there. I was one of the crazy people that stood online to meet George Martin. If my niece wanted his autograph.
I saw that line. That line went down the corridor, around the corner, down
uh-huh.
another corridor, around the corner, and it just, it's
mm-hmm.
the longest line I've ever seen. I've seen lines for Lee Child and Dennis Lehane and so many other famous writers, James Patterson,
mm-hmm.
but the George R. R. Martin line was the longest I've ever seen.
Yeah, and I was disappointed because I asked him if he wanted me to review his book, and he just said, ask that guy over there. And I said, oh, well, what could you do? What could you do?
Oh, my goodness. Well, when
yeah,
you reach a certain
I
level, I guess you have people.
What can I tell you? So he found who's Harry? And when the police contact him, they just say to him, well, you know, Sam, just give up. You're guilty. Thank God Sam didn't do that.
Yes, because Billy's fate is not the best for him. Now the local police are involved, so Sam Teagarden now has two different organizations pursuing him and wanting him for entirely different reasons. The local police constabulary wants him because Billy came to some, the 11-year-old boy Billy Carney came to some harm, which was specifically arranged by this team that originally wanted to kill Sam Teagarden. So that original team turns out to be some black ops hitmen, and Teagarden is no dummy. He's a smart man, although he is kind of the every American in that he doesn't know karate and he doesn't know anything about. He's never been in a soldier, but he does figure out that he has now this black ops hit team trying to kill him. But he still doesn't know why. Although he does understand why the local police want him, because poor Billy Carney should not have strayed too close to Sam Teagarden's yard. So, the Catskills, if you know it, is the home of Hasidic communities.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hasidic communities have been going to the Catskills, really, for well over a century. And so there are all sorts of little camps and compounds hidden among the woods. And Sam Teagarden stumbles upon one of them. And once he gets into a compound that's not unoccupied at the moment, he manages to log onto a really old computer called Compaq. You remember those computers? And it probably dates to about the 1980s.
Yeah.
And so he logs on and he checks the local news and he figures out, well, yes, the local police are after him. And then suddenly the screen goes to blank and it reappears. And it is the man that's trying to, the black ops hitman who's leading the team of hitmen that are trying to chase after Sam Teagarden. And they have this rather strange communication online, and Sam has no idea how they managed to take over this ancient computer and actually communicate with him. But they knew that he had logged on because he used his logon and his password, which, of course, they were tracing. And that's when he realized these people are really dangerous. They are sociopaths, and I've got to get out of the Catskills. And so he manages to get away from this little Hasidic compound and going up to the Bethel Woods Arts Center, which is built upon the site of the old Woodstock Rock Festival, where he catches a bus and catches a ride with someone who takes him to town where he catches a bus. And the next thing you know, he's in New York City, and he goes into hiding in New York City. So it's a lot of fun for the reader. Anyone who knows the East Coast will recognize many of these places. And they'll, as one review said, Jason Bourne fans will have a whole lot of fun following this, in part because he is sort of an everyman version of the Jason Bourne character. Good old Sam Teagarden, he doesn't know how to scale the outsides of buildings, as you see Jason Bourne doing in the movie franchise, which I think is a lot of fun and a good alternative. So while he's in New York City, now he has to get some old-fashioned stuff, including cash and a toothbrush, and he manages to check into a local, a very small tourist hotel. And with his computer, he figures out that, well, he's got this mysterious thing in his email inbox, and he opens it, and sure enough, it's an encoded document. And he figures, well, that must be why they're trying to kill him, because it's an old document that was in the FBI library dating really to the 1930s and concluding in the 1970s. And having been once a CIA employee himself many years earlier, where he worked in the encryption-decryption department, he knows a little bit about coding and encoding and decoding. So while he's on the run, he decodes this mysterious document, and it turns out to be a diary. And the diary is written by a man named Clyde Anderson Tolson. Now, most readers would not recognize that name, but he was a real fellow, and he was the number two man in the FBI from the 1930s to the 1970s. And he was also the number one man in the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. He was that man's life partner, and in my novel, I presume also his lover and his partner, essentially his husband. They lived together. They didn't live together, but they lived close by, and they had lunch every day, and they had dinner at J. Edgar Hoover's house almost every night. And then, just to spring forward a little bit to verify, in I think it was 73 or 74 when J. Edgar Hoover passed away, Clyde Tolson was at the funeral and received J. Edgar Hoover's flag that draped his coffin. Clyde Tolson also inherited J. Edgar Hoover's entire estate. It was valued at $500,000.
Oh, wow.
Clyde Tolson also inherited J. Edgar Hoover's home in Northwest Washington, and then Clyde Tolson moved into that home. So, you know, it's a long-term rumor or even legend that J. Edgar Hoover was gay, and in my novel, I just assumed that he was gay and that Clyde Tolson was his partner. So when Sam Teagarden, back to the fictional portion, when Sam Teagarden discovers this document and decodes it, he figures out it's a diary, and every diary begins, "Dear John." And it concludes with the signature, Clyde Tolson, Clyde Anderson Tolson, cat. And it's not only a love diary, it tangentially reveals and discusses some of the things that were going on in the FBI in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And it reveals many dark crimes and dark realities committed by the FBI in those years under the direction of Mr. J. Edgar Hoover. And when Sam Teagarden realizes that he's sitting on this document that would fundamentally alter American history, he kind of panics because he realizes that's why they're trying to do me in. They don't want this diary written by Clyde Tolson to be made public, because if it did, the public would come to understand some of the far darker stuff than they ever knew happened in the middle of the 20th century.
There's a lot of things that happen that people don't want them to know. So he's signed in. This I thought was so cool. Goes into a hotel, doesn't have a charge card, manages to get a room. So who is Svilanta? And she appears to be on his side, but does she really want to help him? I wasn't thrilled with her either.
Yes, so it turns out that he checks into the, he selects a small touristy hotel that he thinks might be safe, and he knows that he can't use a credit card because, as he mentions in the novel, as soon as he uses a credit card, before he could even hail a taxi, probably the police would be pulling up. So he goes to this hotel where this nice lady is running the front desk, and he presents cash, and he presents a reservation document that he managed to make at the main library in Midtown Manhattan, and she accepts him, and she's kind of interested in him, which is an offer that he does not have any interest in. But then she realizes, once he shaves his beard, that, and she sees an event in one of the all news network stations, that this man, Sam Teagarden, who is checked into her hotel under a false name, is not exactly who he claims to be. So then she calls the police, and after he stayed, that takes about a day or so to transpire. And after she calls the police, then he has to flee that hotel, and then this Black Ops hit team headed by a man who he now knows his name is Harry McCandless. And mentioned in the novel, Harry McCandless, that's such a polite, innocent, nice name. It doesn't sound like an evil guy at all. But Sam Teagarden is being sued by an FBI Black Ops rogue agent trying to kill him and prevent publication of the Dear John diary. So now this nice lady in this, or not so nice lady, depending on your point of view, in this tourist hotel, she's also in the the crosshairs of Harry McCandless, and it doesn't go well for her. So at this point, Fran, maybe I should mention, you know, there is quite a bit of violence in this novel, even though Sam Teagarden is no spy or secret agent. So it may not be for every reader, but the action does keep going, and it's fast-paced, so therefore maybe the violence is understandable and enjoyable. And if it's ever made into a movie, which I think it should be, the violence would be quite well-known to all moviegoers, so there you go.
Yeah, there's so much fun. My husband loves violent programs, and he makes me watch them, and I'd really just like rather read a book than sometimes read. Yeah, but he's got me hooked on Criminal Minds and Law and Order, which I never watched before. But I know that my best pal, D.P. Lyle, did write for Criminal Minds. So I watched a lot, and he's coming. Yeah, his new book is Sunshine State, and I have it. He doesn't. And he's coming on May 21st, the day the book comes out. I cracked up on Facebook. I said, guess what? I'm reading it. He said, you're kidding me. No.
Oh,
so
that's cool.
Yeah, I get,
there are so many
I get
of
them
programs
before they come
them.
Out. Did you meet Doug? He's so great.
No, I did not, but I would love to. Talking about Criminal Minds and Law and Order, they're wonderful, and there's so many programs on the cable channels now, Netflix and Amazon Prime and Hulu, and of course HBO, and some of them are so addictive. I'm watching Ozark now. I don't know if you watch that.
My husband's watching that. It's like he was watching Game of Thrones, and he loves the X-Files. I can't stand it. I just like, after a while, it's all the same. So, he watches that stuff, too. And then he watches his other favorite program is Untold Stories, the medical programs. He's got me watching those, too. And
talk about
graphic, oh, my God.
They can be really addictive. And some of them are more than just entertainment. Some of them are quite informative. The Medical Files program sounds informative. Is it?
They are. It's a phenomenal program because it's true stories. Some of the people, the real people that get hurt and have the complications, they're explaining it. But they have other people that are acting it out, and some of them are like, oh my God. My niece is going for nursing in Orlando, and I help her with her work and stuff like that. So she's got me watching it too. She says, I just had a case. You might want to watch this. I said, not really, Danny. I don't really want to watch it, but I do it anyway. So we've got. Seriously, and she's taking nursing classes. So far, this last 2 weeks, I've been off the hook, but I can't wait for her to text me and say, this is what you have to help me do, which is okay, because I'm learning a lot. So we have Sam, and what happened? The police find Valenta. So what are the encrypted messages? He's got 34 pages copied. What are they that he's copied them? Because he got them from a guy named Dan.
Yes, Sam now has downloaded the file, which he calls the Dear John file, because he discovers it's a diary, and he encodes one passage slowly with the aid of decryption software that's available to the public online. And he figures out it's a diary, and then he figures out that every passage in the diary begins, Dear John. And then he figures out through other research that the author is Clyde Anderson Tolson, who is keeping this diary about his life with the number one man in the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. And in the process, he's also unintentionally but tangentially revealing and discussing some of the darker facts and missions headed by Mr. Hoover. This is, of course, fiction. It's fiction on my part, speculation about what happened in the 1960s. And in some cases, what he has figured out is that there is a hand here, an unseen hand participating in the assassination of two Kennedys and Dr. King, and that it's all linked to the cranking up of the Vietnam War. So if you can accept that thesis as a fictional possibility or even a realistic plausibility, then you can understand why a Black Ops hit team would not want Sam Teagarden to make this diary public to the wider men and women who would be reading and understanding what it means to the history of the United States. It would be quite an unfortunate event from their point of view, whereas from the public's point of view, we live in a constitutional democracy. They are entitled to know what's going on. And, you know, Fran, when I wrote this, I assumed at the time when I was finishing my first draft that we would have a lady president now. We do not have a lady president.
Yeah, right.
But so, and the fact that I didn't do this intentionally, obviously, because I couldn't foresee the immediate future. But this novel really is about paranoia of a government gone wild and government cover-ups and government alternative and ulterior motives. And it feeds so well into what's going on today with our current presidential administration. And it really applies to both sides of the coin, no matter which side of the political spectrum anyone falls on. Undeniably, the NSA this started during the Obama administration. The NSA was revealed to be overreaching into our phone calls and therefore and our internet experience, and it's continued into the present administration. And so it kind of feeds into what's going on in the headlines every day now. And no matter which side of the political spectrum readers fall on, I think they'll find something realistic here to be concerned about. A throwback to the 1950s and 60s also flashes forward to what's going on today. Past is prologue. If you do not remember history, you're condemned to repeat it, and all of those cliches. And it applies here with, I think, Flight of the Fox and what's happening in the current administration.
I agree with you. I mean, just reading the Google, I get the Google alerts every time somebody's arrested or indicted or something like that. And I'm saying I've never seen a president's cabinet so either fired or indicted or criminal charges or something. And then he put something on Facebook yesterday, and he put it on Twitter. He invoked the Me Too thing because he could do whatever he wants. And I know what the Me Too thought is. So I was like, oh, my God, he really thinks he's above the law. That is really pathetic. But whatever. Hopefully
and
we'll have a change in 2020. We hope.
Well, we'll have to see. Everybody has to go to the polls and make up their decision. But in Flight of the Fox, something very similar is going on. It's a government out of control, and not to reveal too much, not to give a total spoiler, but Sam Teagarden probably will reappear in a sequel, so that kind of tells you that he survives. But it also kind of tells you that certain things are revealed and the government comes to know, the people come to know what the government has been up to in the past, in the mid-20th century. And I think it's important for that to happen in the ending of Flight of the Fox. For even though there's a lot of violence, even though it's an unpleasant situation, and I hope a good page-turner, in the end, The Constitution prevails, the American people prevail, and those who are entitled to know the truth find out the truth. And that's what reflects so well in what's going on today, because you just have the sense that there's a whole lot of stuff that's being covered up, and it's a whole lot of stuff that they don't want us to know, but that I kind of feel like we're all entitled to know.
I agree, but it depends. You know, sometimes, you know, I've read like 1,000,000,000 books here, and then I hear the media say, give their take on something, and sometimes they overdo it and make it worse instead of better. And they have to learn, you know, how to say things without riling up the public too, I guess. And this Twitter thing that the president does, he's the only president, I think, ever that had a phone, cell phone. I thought they were not allowed to say anything. How he got a cell phone is ridiculous. He should not have one like that. And he should think before he writes, seriously.
I think both sides of the political spectrum agree with you on that. I remember when Obama first was elected, he loved his BlackBerry, and they kind of took it away from him. So you're right. I don't know how they managed to allow him to keep his cell, but he certainly does keep it, doesn't he?
Yeah, he says a little too much. My mother always said, think before you write, because the words are going to come back at you. And she was right. So we have McCallus, and he goes rogue. So what has he learned? Who is Dan, and why is Dan hiding? And why does his partner, this was interesting, what do you mean by supreme authority over him and Sam? That was really quite interesting.
So I invented this expression called supreme authority, and it's the counterpart to the fictional 007 James Bond in MI6 in the UK. So everyone who's ever seen or read a 007 book knows that the 00 series means license to kill. That when in service to the Queen and country, you need to take a human life to preserve Queen and country, then you may do so, and that's the case with James Bond 007. So in my Black Ops hit team, I invented an expression that I thought would be appropriate to American vernacular and governmental acronyms and so forth. So I came up with the idea of supreme authority, and supreme authority is what certain agents are granted when they have to take out certain individuals that are determined to be unpleasant to Constitution and nation and people of America. So both Sam Teagarden, and now he's teamed up with another agent because Sam is not successfully done the job Harry McCandless has not successfully done the job on Sam Teagarden, so the FBI sends in a backup guy named Don Erskine. Dan is working with Harry McCandless, and they both have been granted supreme authority. Supreme authority makes them essentially a 00 type character, but only for a single designated target, and that target is Mr. Sam Teagarden, who at this point has managed to escape New York City and is now in Washington, D.C. And there's more action there in Washington, D.C., where Sam is hooked up with a girlfriend, a lady friend who is crazy about him, and he's crazy about her. And they try to contact sources in the federal government that may be on their side, And they're trying to get the word out that even though, yes, he's a fugitive, he's an innocent fugitive, and in fact, he's really a whistleblower because he's decoded this file, and the file needs to be made. So they're looking for allies in the federal government, and they find one in the Speaker of the House. And then we take it from there, and the Speaker of the House tries to make sure and determine that it's a legitimate claim and that there's this man who is thought to have harmed an 11-year-old boy in upstate New York, and they discover that there are, in fact, black ops hit teams in the FBI that the government doesn't know about, that elected representatives didn't even know existed, and the American people certainly didn't know existed because they're secret. And so that advances the plot and the narrative even forward on until other stuff happens in Washington, D.C. that is also a matter of the page-turning aspect of this thriller.
Yes, it is. The interesting part is I do panel shows. I'm doing a wild one with five authors, including Claudia Negers and Alan Topol, in December, and we're talking about how do you pick your character, how do you pick his occupation, how do you pick the trouble that the person gets into, and how do you pick the title of your book? And I thought that would be hilariously different. They loved it. But I am going to do another one in January, and I want to do one on, and I've been speaking to you and other authors on location. How do you pick the different locations in your novel, and how do they relate to where the character goes, and how does it change what happens in the novel? Because I thought, and how do you write your first scene so that it keeps the reader from saying, I want to take the book and throw it somewhere and actually read it? And that's what I'm doing for 2019 to start the year off, rather than just books all the time. But before I forget, Thursday, New York Times author Tom Sawyer, head writer of Murder, She Wrote, will be here with Major Production at 10. And on Tuesday, the 25th, the one and only, she's wild, you have to meet her, Nancy Allen wrote the Juror Number 3 with James Patterson. We're going to talk about it. She's so fun. On the 2nd of October, Michael and Rachel, who created the opening for my show, TrinityHouseEntertainment.inc. We're going to talk about inspirational music and how to make people feel inspired, full of hope and survival. And I listen to the music when I need to smile. It's fantastic. On October 4th, Trish Stevens will be here, and she's sharing her story. She's got multiple sclerosis. That should be interesting. And the one and only on the 8th, Shannon Kirk in the Vines. And that's just some of October, except I'm going to be ending it. There are a few more in between, but I'm going to end it with one of my favorite people, Bruce Coffin, Beyond the Truth on the 30th, the day the book comes out. So that's just some of the antics that I'm up to, and there's plenty more in November and December. So what happens that causes Sam to have, he's on a boat, and he's with this people called Ice Skater and Copper Miner. How come he gets off the boat? What happens on that scene? That was scary.
Okay, so at this point, he's now moved to Key West. Sam Teagarden has managed to escape not only the Catskill Mountains, not only New York City, not only Washington, D.C., but now he's moved on to Key West. And the reason why he gets to Key West is because he has a daughter who works for the United States Navy at the nearby Naval Air Base. That's one island north of Key West, and it's called Boca Chica Key. And they have an air base there. And his daughter works in pilotless aircraft. The Air Force and the Navy are very much working towards pilotless aircraft. They had an X-47 airplane. I think they made two of them that could actually land on an aircraft carrier without a pilot on board. And they tested them and they worked. But then, and the X-47 plays a significant role in the narrative of Flight of the Fox. In reality, since the X-47 was invented and tested, they have mothballed it for reasons that I never did quite understand. But it very much plays into the opening scene, which is, of course, when Sam is attacked by drones. So the whole idea of pilotless aircraft and drones from a full fighter craft size all the way down to about the size of a baseball is a theme throughout the novel. And once he gets to Key West, he hooks up with his daughter who is involved in the X-47 program, and now she has an ally, and she's helping him to hide out until they can follow through with their allies in the federal government. In this case, it's the Speaker of the House who's working with them to get the truth out and to explain the full story. And so there's a climactic scene there in Key West with these two and then ultimately three FBI agents, all three of whom have been granted supreme authority. And the FBI is panicking at this point and making very poor decisions. And Sam Teagarden is outsmarting all of them. And with the aid of his daughter, of course, he not only outsmarts the FBI, but he now outsmarts Harry McCandless, who has gone totally rogue and just wants to get Sam Teagarden because he considers it a challenge because Sam has outsmarted him on a number of occasions. So to poor old the heavy guy, the antagonist, Harry McCandless, doesn't care what happens to him so long as he gets Sam Teagarden. So there's a big climactic scene on a small island called Wisteria Island off the coast of Key West. And then there's further action in the middle of Key West. I don't know if you've ever been to the cemetery in Key West, but it's right in the middle of town. And right there, there are really two Key Wests all on the same island. One is the party part of town, and the other one is the quiet part of town. And the quiet part of town is very much reminiscent of an antebellum southern town with lovely old homes with wraparound porches and all the gingerbread scroll work going around the top of the houses, and they're tree-lined and flowers grow everywhere. So Key West is special in that you can go from the sort of the Caribbean where the action is, and just a few blocks away you walk into this charming southern town. And I have my characters going back and forth between both of those two aspects of the Key West life. And that's basically where the story ends, except for the actual ending, which takes place back in Washington, D.C., and as I said, the people of America win the day. So there's the basic narrative of Flight of the Fox. I'm glad it was a page-turner for you. I feel like it is a page-turner for others. And if people read it, you know, as a writer, I'm learning how important it is to go online to the various Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Indie Books and Goodreads and review. And it isn't so much a matter of importance if you give one star or five stars. What's important is just that you review, because the publishing industry and other readers pay attention to the volume of the comments being made, and then secondarily to the specificity of the comments being made. So that's kind of important if readers could go and do that, and I would encourage that. By the way, I just want to say, when you were mentioning coming up in October, that's quite a terrific month you've got coming up, and I've actually met Bruce Coffin. He's a good guy. I'm gonna listen in to several of those, and I'm gonna listen in when Bruce Coffin is on.
Oh, thank you. Because the next day, on the first November 1st, I have. This is funny. I walked up to him, to Bruce, because I know Bruce, and I said, "It's about time you met me." So he gives me a big hug and says, "And it's about time you met James Heyman, who was sitting right next to him." And I looked at James. I said, "And I haven't read your book. Why?" So he handed me The Cutting, which was scary as anything, and I'm doing Fatal Obsession on the 1st of November, because Partners in Crime does all of their blog tours. They're phenomenal. And if I ever get done writing my 20th book, they might do my next one again. And, yeah, they give me something because I do this for fun, and I love doing it. And for those people that think their friend gets paid, she does not. No. I've been doing this when my sister told me that I'm very thin, but I weighed 200 pounds when I had to retire from teaching. In 2003, my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So my sister said to me, "I bet you can review a book." I said, "I bet you don't know what you're talking about." And I reviewed a cookbook, and I don't cook. And they're still laughing at what I wrote, but it went viral. And that's how that started. And the first author that I ever had the guts to ask to be on my radio show was Tess Gerrinson. And, yeah, she did it, and she's going to be on November 14th, everyone, because she's got her new movie, Island Zero, that I have to not be scared and watch. So, yeah. This has been fun, but you know what? You said something about reviews. The one thing I learned about a review was my 5 stars are on Amazon, trust me, and it's on my site. I posted it this morning. A lot of people just read it and say, "Oh, I like the book. It's great." That's not a review. You're going to write a review,
write
what you think about the book. And when people write, and I got one for my Faces Behind the Stone series. Everybody gave me like 4 stars, 5 stars. And this girl gave me 2 stars. She said, "I don't know what the book is about. I didn't finish reading it." I said, "Well, in that case, I'm going to discount what you wrote. I don't care." I mean, that gets me. Because if you're going to write a review, then write something that applies to the book. I don't write negative reviews. If a book is in 3.5, 4 stars, I just do a summary and I give it to the author and I don't review it. Because it's not my place to pan somebody's writing. I won't do that. So, let's get back. We have about 10 minutes. And this is like, I'm excited that you're writing another one, because I have to find out what happens to Sam next. I can't wait to see what you do to this poor guy. And my question is, are you going to team him up with Cynthia, because they belong together, or are you going to, no love interest for poor Sam? Seriously.
Cynthia is very much in Sam Teagarden's future life, and they live together in New York in the next novel, and in fact they have something called Wedded Bliss. So that's important.
Oh,
and yes, they very much are partners in the next novel. I hope to surprise the reader with the next novel in a number of ways, also pertaining to the FBI and the government and trying to right other wrongs, and while trying to also prevent interesting things and crimes going on in a different part of the world. And in the sequel, I'm sending Sam Teagarden to places like Israel, Italy, and Berlin,
nice.
Germany. I think that would be fun.
And when is this coming out?
Well, I don't think it's going to be in the first part of 2019, maybe in the latter part of 2019 or early 2020. You know, what's interesting, Fran, is, of course, I'm sure you know, the publishing industry moves at a glacier pace. I was in broadcast news myself for 30 years, and in radio, we not only watch the minute hand, we watch the second hand. But in publishing, they look at the years, sometimes the months, but frequently the years. And it's just an interesting change of pace to have a schedule where you're working on a project that's maybe 1 year in advance instead of 5 seconds away. In radio, you're really got to be on top of your game and everything that's going on, so you know what that's like. And as a book critic and a reader and a writer yourself, you mm-hmm. you also know what's going on in publishing. It's really quite a contrast. It was quite an adjustment for me to go from broadcasting to publishing, but I'm getting used to it. You just put it on the calendar, you know, 18 months in advance or 10 months in advance and work towards that goal.
Well, I was on radio on Friday, and I was interviewed by Mike Pomp, open mic on 1270, 98.1 FM. I was honored to be interviewed about my book, A Daughter's Promise. So I know how it feels to be like, and they said they were going to do 15 minutes, and it was more like 35 minutes. And I was totally honored. I could not believe that I did that. And I wasn't nervous.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
You were nervous?
No, not at all.
No,
not
good,
at all.
Good,
I was not nervous at all. I was impressed with myself. I'm going, like, you did this and you didn't even know. And I had no idea what he was going to ask. And I had the book in front of me, and I was able to define everything that they wanted to know. And he said that the show seemed very well. It was live. And I said, okay, this is no problem. So it was fun, and the promise I made was never to put my mom in a nursing home. And I kept my word. So that was fun. So radio was fun, and I prefer that to TV because this way I can put my feet up and I don't have to sit and worry about makeup, hair, and whatever, which I do anyway.
There you go. And it's also very personal. When you put that headset on and that microphone is in front of you, it just sparks something, and it's a very personal experience where you're connecting to the listener.
That is so true. And I have fun doing this. So we have about 10 minutes, but there's something like, I know Eva's the daughter. Who is Pangolin? And what is the significance of the Bible and the verse? I thought that was interesting. I look up everything.
Oh, the Bible was back when Sam is, not Sam.
Yes.
It takes place in Washington, D.C., where the Speaker of the House is starting to come around to Sam Teagarden's side and his girlfriend, Cynthia Blair, and he thinks that he comes to understand that Sam Teagarden is, in fact, a whistleblower instead of a murderer, as they're casting him to be. And so he goes to the oldest serving member of Congress, totally fiction, who is a Republican and who is intensely right-wing and very religious. And so my fictional Speaker of the House knows that in order to reach this man and get this man on his side and help open up windows and doors for Sam Teagarden to survive and for this dear John File, this mysterious encoded diary to be made public, he knows that he has to render an ally out of this Republican elderly gentleman who's the longest serving congressman in the history of the United States. So, because he's religious, he opens up the Bible and he starts to make allegory in comparison to the situation that they're both experiencing compared to what can be found in the Bible. And my Speaker of the House was raised by nuns in Catholic school down in Louisiana. So he knows the Bible well, and they talk about the parable of the virgins, where you have to have enough oil in your lamp to be prepared for when the truth arrives. And in some measure, you could say that Sam Teagarden is a bearer of an unpleasant truth, and it's time for that unpleasant truth to arrive. And so he renders or seeks to render this elderly gentleman to be an ally in his effort to open doors for Sam Teagarden so that the truth can be known to the public. And, of course,
it's not safe to be next to Sam Teagarden, people. I wouldn't go too close, people. No, seriously. It's not a smart thing to do. Seriously. So, we've got that, and McCallis, and he has his own plan. So, who is Thomas Rose, and why is he going after the other two agents? Everybody's going after everybody. Poor Sam and the rest of the people. It's not safe to be in the FBI or CIA in this book. I'll tell you that.
So, Thomas Rose is the third agent, black ops agent to be granted supreme authority. And because the FBI is panicking and because Sam Teagarden is outsmarting them, the third agent, Thomas Rose, is sent in to mop up everything. And and it's just an example of how bureaucracy and bureaucrats think, and how that sort of attitude messes everything up. And Sam Teagarden senses it and understands that if he's smart enough, he can make the bureaucracy play against itself and ultimately be an ally for him, which is one of the aspects of writing this novel that I love, because instead of karate chops and gunplay, Sam Teagarden figures out what the psychology of his nemesis consists of and how to use it against him, and in the case of the FBI, how to use the psychology against the entire organization, because he senses that they are panicking and they're making very bad decisions contrary to their own interests. And that's the case with Thomas Rose, who is the third agent sent in with supreme authority to not only kill Sam Teagarden, but to also kill Harry McCandless, the first FBI agent, and Dan Donorsk, the second FBI agent, because the FBI doesn't want any record of this to be made public. And in the end, of course, as I've already hinted, well, the American people win out.
Well, you'll see how, because we're not going to tell you how, because you have to read it. So,
it's true.
Questions.
It's true.
The final encounter between McCandless and Sam scared the daylights out of me. How did you coordinate all of these pieces, and how did his daughter come into play, and is she going to be in the next one?
His daughter is still around in the next one, yeah.
Oh,
she's
good.
Still down there in Boca Chica Key. She's still working for the United States Navy. And she does not go to Europe with Sam in the sequel, or at least she doesn't yet. I haven't finished the sequel yet. I'm still completing the first draft, but I'm soon to complete it, and then I'll be working on the second draft. So she's still down there, and Cynthia is now his spouse, and they kind of work together on a new case that takes them to Europe. But the big climatic scene that takes place on Wisteria Island, which is a little man-made island, it really exists. It's off the coast of Key West, and there's nothing on it except just vegetation. And that's where, finally, Sam Teagarden and Harry McCandless meet, almost like an old Western movie where they're in the middle of the street on Main Street, and they encounter each other in an old-style shootout, you might call it. And Pangolin, you mentioned him, Pangolin is a nickname for Sam's daughter's boyfriend. He was once a fighter pilot and dropped out of the Navy, and his nickname as a fighter pilot was Pangolin. And then he comes to Sam's Tea Garden, and finally, with the aid of the Speaker of the House in Washington and Pangolin and his daughter there in Key West, they manage to figure out a plan on how to finally put an end to the madness. And so, you know, there's a climactic scene, and yes, there is some violence there, but you read it, so you know there is violence throughout this book. I just hope it's pertinent violence to the page-turning aspect of the thriller. And so far, the reviews that I'm seeing and comments I'm being told, it works for people.
It works
that's
for me,
rewarding.
And my 5 stars are on there. And my Just Reviews is on there. And I read it over this morning, and I'm saying, okay, girl, you didn't have any spoilers. This is good. Because the questions that I asked and the characters that are in there, I said, okay, good, I don't have to. I try not to put spoilers in my review. I actually don't. And like I said, I got eye strain reading this, and my husband is looking at me because he just finished. He never reads anything that I read, ever. So he just read The Killing Room by Peter May. You don't want to miss that. That was phenomenal. And Andrew Gross's Button Man that's coming out in October is absolutely fantastic. Those are two that you want to read. T. Jefferson Parker, Sweet Vengeance, oh my God. And of course, The Flight of the Fox by Gary Bathnight. And he's looking at me saying, when you're done with the interview, please hand me the book. So that is a
wonderful
high compliment, because he doesn't read anything that I read. Nothing.
Oh.
So before we end, where can we find out about you and your work? And I'm excited. And do you have anything in between this coming out besides the second sequel to this one?
Not just yet. There are possibilities in the works. I do try to work
okay
in different genres, and I do have a young adult, but that has not yet found a home, although I'm very much working on it. As for finding me, it's graybassnight.com, and that's my website, and of course there's a page there on my website where you can contact me, email me directly, and I love hearing from readers and anyone else with suggestions, comments, questions. And there are lots of blogs that I've written pertaining to Flight of the Fox. So if you just Google the name, it's spelled BASGRAYBASNIGHT. And check out the blogs on Flight of the Fox and other novels that I've written. This is my third novel, and I hope to have the fourth out within, you know, within 1 year, as I mentioned. And with a little bit of luck, I'll be able to spread my wings a little bit and also write in the young adult genre, which I'm looking forward to trying.
That is one of my favorites, and I do young adults because I have a whole bunch of young adult nephews and nieces that would definitely read it. As a matter of fact, I read Frame by James Ponte because my nephew needed to read it for school, so I read it with him. It's phenomenal. So I love those kind of books. But I want to thank you so much, and I hope I get the next one before it comes out, of course, so that I can schedule an interview. This is a pleasure. Thank you so much. Every day, everybody, the sun is out. It's not raining, and it's going to pour any minute. Well, not yet. And Florence, we love you, but we would prefer if you would stay away from New York and Upper Westchester. Thank you so much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you, Friendwood. Bye.